tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The Islamic State group has released a photo of the bomb it says was used to bring down a Russian passenger plane in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula last month, killing all 224 people aboard. The picture was published in the latest issue of the extremist group's English language magazine with a caption, "Exclusive," an image of the IED used to bring down the Russian airliner. The picture showed a yellow can of Schweppes Gold soda and what appeared to be other bomb components. The extremist group had previously claimed to have downed the plane without offering further details. Russia's FSB security service said Tuesday that a bomb had brought down the plane. Most of those on board were Russian tourists. Egypt says it's still investigating the cause of the crash. Nigeria's leader has ordered the arrest of the former president's national security advisor for allegedly stealing billions of dollars meant to buy weapons to fight Boko Haram Islamic extremists rampaging across northeastern Nigeria. Thousands of needless Nigerian deaths would have been avoided if the money had been properly spent. That is according to Femi Adesina, an advisor to President Muhammadu Buhari, in a statement Tuesday night. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir said Wednesday that his country will struggle to resettle thousands of refugees and those displaced internally during nearly 2 years of war, saying that low world oil prices had depleted government coffers. South Sudan has been mired in conflict since December 2013, when clashes broke out in Juba between troops loyal to Kiir and soldiers backing Riek Machar. VOA News. The United Nations says Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will not be traveling to North Korea next week, despite media reports saying otherwise. In a statement Wednesday, a UN spokesman said the UN chief will be in New York for most of the week before heading to Malta for the Commonwealth Summit. From there, Mr. Ban travels to Paris to attend global climate change talks. At least two people are dead and seven others have been detained after an anti-terrorist operation in northern Paris linked to last week's attacks around the French capital. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris that the fate of the suspected mastermind in the attacks, Abdelhamid Abouad, is unclear.
The dead include a woman who set off her explosives vest during the seven-hour standoff with police early Wednesday in the suburb of Saint-Denis. Another seven people were detained during the raid that targeted an apartment in the central part of town.
Dans le cadre de cette enquête, nous avons il y a beaucoup de travail qui a été effectué.
Following the operation, Paris prosecutor François Moulins confirmed it targeted Belgian jihadist Abdelhamid Abaoud, the suspected mastermind of last week's attacks that killed 129 people. Meanwhile, the search continues for suspects and accomplices linked to the Paris attacks. Another key suspect, Brussels-born Salah Abdeslam, may still be on the loose. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The UN Nuclear Agency is set to release a report on whether Iran is meeting its commitments to a deal that is meant to reduce Tehran's ability to make atomic arms. That report is expected Wednesday and may show little progress, however. Iran has said it's holding back on implementing the agreement until next month's publication of another report by the UN International Atomic Energy Agency that details its conclusions on allegations that Tehran worked in the past on nuclear arms. Iran denies those allegations. A protest by desperate Cuban migrants stranded on their journey to the United States paralyzed a key border crossing between Costa Rica and Nicaragua Tuesday. Long lines of buses and trucks formed on both sides of the border as the migrants refused to let traffic pass, according to authorities in both countries. More than 2,000 Cubans are stuck at the border, penniless and without immigration papers. The death toll from 2 days of rains and flooding in western Saudi Arabia rose to at least eight Wednesday, including three children, according to public safety officials. Most of the fatalities came in the Medina area in the kingdom's west, where five bodies were recovered. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
At least two people are dead and seven others have been detained after an anti-terrorist operation in northern Paris linked to last week's attacks around the French capital. The fate of the suspected mastermind in the attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud, is unclear.
That's Lisa Bryant reporting from Paris. Details coming up.
Also in Nigeria, suicide bombers kill at least 32 people and wound 80 at a marketplace in the city of Yola.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, at least two people are dead and seven others have been detained after an anti-terrorist operation in northern Paris linked to last week's attacks around the French capital. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris that the fate of the suspected mastermind in the attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud, is unclear.
The dead include a woman who set off her explosives vest during the seven-hour standoff with police early Wednesday in the suburb of Saint-Denis. Another seven people were detained during the raid that targeted an apartment in the central part of town.
Dans le cadre de cette enquête, nous avons il y a beaucoup de travail qui a été effectué.
Following the operation, Paris prosecutor François Molins confirmed it targeted Belgian jihadist Abdelhamid Abaoud, the suspected mastermind of last week's attacks that killed 129 people. He said the identities of those killed and detained were still being verified. More clarity is expected later in the day. Abaoud, who has been linked to other terrorist operations, was previously reported to be in Syria. Reports suggest he may have traveled to Europe at least once this year, underscoring larger concerns about intelligence lapses and the security risk posed by returning jihadists.
Le porte-avions Charles de Gaulle vient d'appareiller. Il nous permettra en Méditerranée.
In a speech to French mayors, President François Hollande outlined a series of measures to fight the Islamic State group, which has claimed responsibility for the attack. France launched a third set of airstrikes against IS targets in Syria and is deploying the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean to reinforce its strike capacity. Hollande is also calling for a grand coalition that includes both the United States and Russia to fight IS. Closer to home, the government wants to extend the current state of emergency for another 3 months. Hollande also says he wants to change the French constitution to better deal with terrorism and other crises, a proposal that has drawn criticism from rights advocates. Meanwhile, the search continues for suspects and accomplices linked to the Paris attacks. Another key suspect, Brussels-born Salah Abdeslam, may still be on the loose. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Turkish state media say 10 migrants are missing in the Aegean after their boat sank off the Turkish coast. Another five migrants were rescued from the craft that was headed to the Greek island of Kos. Greece Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is meeting today in Ankara with Turkish leaders to discuss reducing the flow of migrants by human traffickers from Turkey to Greece. Yesterday, Turkish fans booed during the playing of the Greek national anthem and a minute of silence in memory of the 129 victims of the Paris attacks. They were watching a soccer match between the national teams of Turkey and Greece. Mr. Tsipras and Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu were also attending the match. Meanwhile, the Associated Press says King Abdullah II of Jordan met with officials in Austria this week. He says the fight against terror and the migrant crisis are linked and is asking for economic help for millions of Syrian refugees.
In Nigeria, police and Red Cross officials say a Tuesday night suicide bombing killed at least 32 people and wounded 80 at a marketplace in the city of Yola. The explosion ended 3 weeks of relative calm in this northeastern state of Adamawa last month. Bombers killed 42 and wounded more than 100 at mosque in two cities in the region. Boko Haram has resorted to more suicide bombings of civilian targets since the military forces of Nigerian and neighboring countries retook large portions of the region once occupied by Boko Haram. More than 2 million people have been displaced and thousands killed in the militants' six-year effort to occupy the region. In related news, President Muhammadu Buhari ordered the arrest last night of a former security advisor to ex-president Goodluck Jonathan on corruption charges. Sambo Dasuki has been accused of awarding non-existent contracts to purchase an estimated $2 billion in arms to fight against Boko Haram. The contracts were to purchase 12 helicopters, 4 fighter jets, and munitions. Dasuki has denied the charges. His arrest is part of an investigation of more than $5.4 billion in fictional arms purchases. An advisor to Mr. Buhari says the president has also ordered the arrest of other former high-ranking officials linked to the scandal. Dasuki, 60, is a retired Army lieutenant colonel. He has participated in every coup in Nigeria since the 1980s. Nigeria's State Security Service has kept Dasuki under house arrest for more than a week. He has also pleaded innocent to charges of money laundering involving more than $423,000 found in cash and illegal possession of arms seized at two of his homes. Critics had questioned the ineffectiveness of Nigeria's once powerful military forces, despite an annual defense budget of between $5 and $6 billion and a 2014 loan of $1 billion.
Guinea's last Ebola patient has recovered and the countdown is on. If there are no new Ebola cases for 42 days, the World Health Organization will declare Guinea Ebola-free. Karim Kamara reports from Conakry.
The countdown began Monday after Guinea discharged its last Ebola case, a three-week-old baby. Her parent and four other family members died. The remaining 68 people under quarantine have been released after testing negative. The head of the National Coordination for the Fight Against Ebola, Dr. Sakoba Keta, says Guinea will continue community education and radio campaigns. He says if he is confident, if they continued these methods, the World Health Organization will declare the end of Ebola in Guinea on December 29th. He says that will be a special year-end gift for the country. He said they identified the maximum number of contacts possible related to the last known cluster of cases. He says in July last year, we were almost close to the end of Ebola when infected people from Sierra Leone in Liberia entered the country, sparking fresh outbreaks. But this time, he says things are different. Guinea was the last country reporting new cases. The WHO declared Sierra Leone Ebola-free on November 7th and Liberia on September 3rd. On the street of Conakry, people are welcoming the news cautiously.
To what I'm telling the government, they should not fold their hands. Guinea, everything has slowed down because of Ebola. This is a good news, but we are worried as all. Until we see the government deploying more effort.
Teacher Mohamed Kamara says the government should not fold their hands. He says everything has slowed down because of Ebola. He says this is a good news, but we are worried and want to see the government keep up its effort. This regional epidemic, the worst Ebola outbreak in history, began in Guinea's southwestern forest region almost 2 years ago. More than 28,000 contracted the virus and more than 11,000 died. Experts are encouraging continued vigilance. Scientists are concerned that the virus may remain active in bodily tissues or semen for possibly months after recovery. Guinea has closed all its Ebola treatment units, but those in Conakry and the west of the country remain open, just in case. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
Fifth 15 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new study outlines dual problems with antibiotics. The first is a lack of access to the drugs in many areas, while the second is growing antibiotic resistance. The study by the British medical journal The Lancet says many lives are being lost as a result. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The Lancet study is supported by researchers at the New York-based Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy. Ramadan Lakshmanarayan is CDDEP director. He says many children needlessly die from disease each year for want of antibiotics.
We have two problems here. One is that not enough people in the world have access to effective antibiotics. And the second is many of them, even when they get access to an antibiotic, may have resistant infection, which means the antibiotics are not working for them anymore.
He says increasing the use of antibiotics in about 100 countries could prevent many deaths.
We estimate that if you universally provide antibiotics, we could save about 440,000 deaths just with pneumonia every year. Now, resistance is also a problem, and here we estimate that there are probably about 200,000 plus deaths associated with infections in newborns around the world. So this too is a problem.
The lack of access to antibiotics usually occurs in low and middle income countries.
There is a lack of access simply because of a lack of affordability. A lot of people are just too poor to be able to buy an antibiotic. That's number one. Number two, when they do get an antibiotic, it might be spurious or it might be a fake drug. So the idea is not just to get access to an antibiotic, it's to get access to an effective antibiotic.
The World Health Organization has launched a global campaign to raise awareness about antibiotic resistance, a program called Antibiotics, Handle with Care.
Well, antibiotic resistance is a consequence of the use, overuse, and misuse of antibiotics, both for human health as well as in agriculture and aquaculture. About two-thirds of antibiotics are used globally in the agricultural sector. The one-third that is used in humans, a lot of it is inappropriate use. Even in the United States, probably over half of the antibiotics that are used are inappropriate.
Lakshmanarayan says too many people think of antibiotics as a cure-all that can be easily used without any consequences. He says that's not true.
When we overuse antibiotics, we reduce the chance that it's going to work for us in the future. It lowers the chance that it's going to work for people that are close to us, and then, of course, for the rest of society. This is a huge public health issue around the world. Much like HIV, it connects both the developed and the developing world.
He says many people in urban areas are able to buy antibiotics without a prescription. That contributes to resistance. The Lancet study says there are several things that can be done.
We can begin with a few things. We can reduce use of antibiotics in agriculture. Even in the United States, a lot of the antibiotics are given subtherapeutically. What that means is the antibiotics are given to animals in very low concentrations with their feed every day, ostensibly to make them grow faster and also to prevent disease. Phasing that out would probably cut out about 25% of the antibiotics that we use today. Better hospital infection control can help.
Many patients catch infections while they're in a hospital. Antibiotic use rises sharply during the flu season. Even though antibiotics are not effective against viruses, the drugs are widely and inappropriately prescribed. Lakshmanarayan says more widespread use of the flu and pneumococcal vaccines could greatly reduce the use of antibiotics to prevent possible secondary infections.
For pneumonia, in many countries, the children don't get the antibiotic on time. So I would say that a child with pneumonia does need antibiotics, but in many instances, they don't get them, which is why we lose probably over 500,000 children every year just to that one disease.
He says any new antibiotics that are developed cannot be administered the way current medications are. Otherwise, they too would become ineffective against many infections.
They wouldn't last very long. That's number one. Number two, any investment in new antibiotics today is going to take years and years to pay off. So this isn't any sort of an immediate solution to the problem that we have today. The newest antibiotics cost thousands of dollars, and we have to ask ourselves, do we really want to pay thousands of dollars for a new antibiotic, or do we want to conserve the antibiotics that we have that cost, under $20?
The Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy recently warned of more deaths following organ transplant surgeries and cancer chemotherapy because antibiotics have become less effective against opportunistic infections. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Vatican officials continue to closely monitor the situation in Central African Republic. It's scheduled to be the last stop on Pope Francis's trip to Africa late this month. They're concerned about the Pope's safety amid violence that first erupted in 2013 with the toppling of President François Bozizé. Fighting between Muslim rebels and Christian militias has left many civilians dead or displaced. Pope Francis is scheduled to visit Kenya, Uganda, and CAR. However, the Vatican Secretary of State, Pietro Parolin, says the last leg of the trip could be cancelled if deemed unsafe. Vatican officials say the Pope would like to open the Jubilee or Holy Year at the cathedral in Bangui.
As Yehias mentioned, Pope Francis travels to Kenya next week to kick off his first Africa tour, and the excitement is building. Since becoming Pope in March 2013, Pope Francis has been shaking up the church with his progressive views on everything from homosexuality to divorce. He has made headlines for his comments on relaxing restrictions for divorced Catholics, possible support for married priests, and more compassion for gay people. Joel Craig visited a Nairobi Catholic church to see how the Pope's less traditional views are being received.
Churchgoers here at Nairobi's Holy Family Minor Basilica may seem just a bit more joyful this Sunday as they prepare for the arrival of a special visitor to their country.
Actually, we are waiting a message of hope from Pope, from how he conducts himself. I think he will bring a good impact and a positive attitude to people, and we should embrace what he's bringing to Kenyans because he's our role model.
Pope Francis is seen as more progressive than his predecessors. The question is how those views will resonate with Africans during his first visit to the continent. In the past decade, Kenya has seen breakaway orders of Catholic priests who decided to get married. Pope Francis has not condoned this, but he has reportedly said the Vatican is looking into the question of married priests. Adonai Tendwa doesn't believe that priests should be allowed to get married.
Because it's better for someone leading others spiritually, being single, just the way he is. You know, if you say he's going to get married, some things will come in. He needs to take care of the family. He has stress of the family, the wife, and everything. I think spiritually it will affect.
Samuel Gitao agrees.
When they marry, I feel they not be able to concentrate in the church affairs, yeah.
Pope Francis has said he wants to see a greater role for women in Catholicism, but that he is against ordaining women priests. Church usher Josephine Kivuva agrees.
Because the men are the ones who have been priests up till now, and they have done pretty a good job. And also, I think the disciples that Jesus chose when he was here on earth, they were all men, particularly maybe for a reason, for us to take as an example.
But Rogers Mwindwa says women should get the opportunity too.
Yes, because in the kingdom of God, even women should have some part to play.
It is on the topic of homosexuality that Pope Francis may most diverge with church members in Africa. While the Pope says marriage should remain an institution between a man and a woman, he has not categorically ruled out civil unions. And he has urged love and mercy for gay people, asking who is he to judge them. Kenya, on the other hand, outlines its stance clearly. Homosexuality is illegal. Church members say they do not condone it.
Homosexuality shouldn't be there. Yeah, because at the first, in the book, in the Bible we read, we need to get married and bring up children. Now when you bring homosexuality, that one will not be having a family.
But Catholics here say they are ready to set differences of opinion aside.
When the Pope gives us direction, we need to follow it according to the tradition of the church.
Pope Francis is scheduled to arrive in Nairobi November 25th. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Cambodia's opposition leader, Sam Rainsy, is accusing the ruling party of carrying out a constitutional coup after a local court issued an arrest warrant for him and a parliamentary committee stripped him of his seat. In a message published on Facebook, the politician says the ruling party is taking measures to try to eliminate the country's main opposition party. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
Opposition leader Sam Rainsy was originally scheduled to return to Cambodia late Monday after visits to Japan and South Korea. But he postponed his arrival after a court issued an arrest warrant for him on Friday, and a parliamentary committee controlled by the ruling party subsequently stripped him of his legal immunity and his seat. Rainsy has yet to fix a return date. On Wednesday, the Cambodia Daily newspaper reported that negotiations were underway to organise a deal between the opposition leader and strongman Prime Minister Hun Sen, who has ruled the country for three decades. The standoff caps weeks of rising tensions between the ruling party and the opposition. Late last month, the ruling Cambodian People's Party's legislators voted to fire the opposition's deputy head, Kem Sokha, from his parliamentary post. Days earlier, a mob severely beat two opposition lawmakers as they left parliament, as police and security guards stood by. Later that day, a mob attacked Kem Sokha's private residence. The police ignored pleas for help from his wife, who was trapped inside their home. Many people believe the ruling CPP ordered the attacks, though a party spokesman denied that was the case. Political analyst U Virak, the founder of the think tank The Future Forum, says the current discord has strong echoes with the ruling party's actions before the 2008 and 2013 general elections.
It has worked magic in the past, so Hun Sen is looking at this as a page from an old playbook, and he's definitely in some way is going back to the same tactic that has worked for him so cheaply, so easily, by just bringing legal charge with a court that he has full control over.
The opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party, or CNRP, stunned the ruling party when it came close to winning the 2013 general election, losing by just 300,000 votes, or around 4% of the electorate. Virak says the ruling party realises that its 2013 pledge to enact reforms is proving hard to carry out, which is why it is now trying to divide the opposition ahead of the 2018 ballot.
After the 2013 election, which was a very, very close election, the CPP thought that you can actually look at reforms and try to attract young voters. I think they realize it's actually much more difficult, particularly with an entrenched, corrupt system that they've built, that they have. So they are now they're basically resorting to old tactics, old dirty tactics, and which is using the courts, which they have full control to bring about legal harassment of Mr. Somerset that has worked magic in the past and still worked today.
Overnight, the spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described the arrest warrant against Rainsy and the earlier attacks on opposition MPs as, quote, worrisome developments, end quote, and urged both parties to resume talks. It has been a difficult year for the opposition. 15 activists were jailed earlier this year after being convicted of insurrection, and a senator is currently awaiting trial on the charge of forging a public document. The cases against them are widely regarded as politically motivated. The arrest warrant against Rainsy relates to a 2011 court decision in which he was found guilty in absentia of defamation and ordered to serve 2 years in jail, after stating that Foreign Minister Hornam Hong helped to run a Khmer Rouge prison during Pol Pot's brutal 1970s rule. However, that conviction was widely believed to have been quashed ahead of the 2013 election, when Rainsy was issued a royal pardon, allowing him to return from exile to contest the vote. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, exceptional future leaders will gather for this year's World Bank's Youth Summit to tell the story of young people's role in the fight against climate change. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests discussing how youth can inspire communities everywhere to take action. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. At least two people are dead and seven others have been detained after an anti-terrorist operation in northern Paris today. And in Nigeria, police and Red Cross officials say suicide bombings killed at least 32 people and wounded 80 at a marketplace in the city of Yola. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, an outgoing United States ambassador to Zimbabwe says not enough has been done by Harare to warrant America to lift the so-called targeted sanctions. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off again with African football.
Kim, joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, 20 African teams have officially qualified for the final round in the qualifying campaign for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. We'll take a look at all 20 teams going in alphabetical order and how they advanced. We begin with Algeria, the Desert Foxes. Well, they don't just kick sand in the faces of Tanzania. It was almost like a sandstorm, David. 7-0 in the second leg, and they win 9-2 on aggregate. Your thoughts?
Sunny, they just missed equaling the record. The record is an 8-goal victory margin, and it's held by Libya and the Democratic Republic of Congo. I have to admit a little bit of bias as I was watching the closing minutes. I thought, come on, Algeria, score just one more and equal the record. But one must also sympathize with the Tanzanians, who in the first match actually led 2-0, but conceded 2 goals in 3 minutes midway through the second half. So that finished 2-2. But as the Tanzanians made the long flight to North Africa, I don't think in their wildest nightmares they would have imagined they were going to get hit for 7. Tanzania, in fact, have been doing very well indeed of late. They beat Mali in the first round. But sandstorm it was, Sunny, and it began in the very first minute. Yassine Brahimi scored. It was 3-0 by halftime, 7 by the end. 2 goals from Gulab, the Napoli defender, and 2 also from Islam Slimani, the Sporting Lisbon striker. And Slimani scored a brace in the first leg as well. So he's among the leading scorers. He's now got 4 goals from 2 matches. Very impressive win indeed for Algeria.
Burkina Faso, the Stallions beat Benin 2-0, and they win 3-2 on aggregate. Your thoughts on the Burkinabe, David?
There are 18 top 20 sides who have qualified for the third round, and the two who haven't, one of them is Burkina Faso. They're currently ranked 22nd in Africa. Their match with Benin was every bit as tight as I predicted on a previous Sunny Side of Sport that it would be. Burkina Faso winning 2-0 in Ouagadougou. They lost the first leg 2-1, so they won that West African derby. A welcome return to the team for Jonathan Pitroipa. He converted a 17th-minute penalty, and then Bertrand Traoré, 20 minutes from the end, scored a second goal. So pretty predictable result for Burkina Faso, but they need to improve, Sunny. A side that haven't really lived up to the expectations of 2013 when they reached the Africa Cup of Nations final and lost just 1-0 to Nigeria. They also came very close to qualifying for the World Cup of 2014, drew 3-3 with Algeria in a playoff, but lost on the away goal rule. But they've slipped back somewhat since, and hopefully this will be a victory that will give them encouragement.
Cameroon, the indomitable Lions with one of the proudest World Cup pedigrees of any African team. They draw 0-0 with Niger in Yaounde. However, they won the series 3-0 on aggregate. Your thoughts on Cameroon, David?
Yes, indeed, Sonny. A rather strange result this, because after winning 3-0 in Miami, you would have certainly expected the indomitable of the Lions go on and win the second leg as well. But Cameroon had a problem similar to South Africa. We'll come to them later. I think, Sonny, when you're 3 goals up, you've got home advantage and you know that basically you're through to the next round. Motivation can be difficult. I know coaches, they talk in the media about the fact that the tie is not over, when privately they know very well indeed that barring a calamity, the tie is indeed over. That said, Cameroon, overall, it's a good victory margin, 3-0. Niger are a combative side. And it's a good start for Alexandra Belinga, the new coach of the Indomitable Lions. Cameroon hold the record for appearances at the World Cup by an African side with 7. And I'm sure they're going to be strong challengers again.
The Cape Verde Islands. The Islanders beat Kenya 2-0. And they win the home and away series 2-1 on aggregate. Your thoughts on Cape Verde, David?
Yeah, this was a close one, Sonny, and I had a chance to watch both matches. And I must say, Cape Verde, ranked 4th in Africa behind Ivory Coast, Algeria, and Ghana, did not look like the side that is the 4th best on the continent. Quite a battle, in fact, to get the better of a Kenyan side who once again shot themselves in the foot. Some of the Kenyan players based overseas, they were not sent their airline tickets. They had to pay for their own. And then there was the normal Kenyan problem of unpaid squad bonuses. And what happened, Sonny, is instead of leaving for the Cape Verde Islands last Saturday to prepare for the second leg, the Kenyans only left on Monday. So they had less than 24 hours to get to the stadium. So a classic case of the Kenyans once again, through poor administration, scoring an own goal. Nevertheless, they fought hard and they held the Cape Verdeans until the stroke of halftime when Ramos, with a header that was deflected into their net, gave the Cape Verde side a 1-0 lead and tied the match on aggregate. And it was Ramos again, 7 minutes into the second half, a really good goal from a cross who made it 2-0 to Cape Verde, but anxious moments towards the end for the Cape Verdeans because they knew that if the Kenyans scored once, they would go through on the away goal rule. So I think, Sonny, a lot of relieved people on the islands of the Cape Verde, not as convincing a victory as they probably expected against the Kenyans, given the fact there is a gap of 93 places between the two nations on the FIFA world rankings.
Congo-Brazzaville. The Congolese defeat Ethiopia 2-1 at home, and they win 6-4 on aggregate. Your thoughts on Congo-Brazzaville, David?
Congo-Brazzaville, one of the sides to win home and away. They had a 4-3 victory in Addis Ababa, an amazing match. The Congolese trailed, then they went 4-1 up, and then it finished 4-3. And Ethiopia did score first in the second leg, but they needed to score a second goal, but that never came. In fact, it was Inyanga who equalized just after halftime. And then one of the stars of the Congolese Red Devils, TV Bafuma, he scored a second goal. So Congo-Brazzaville 2-1 winners on the day and 6-4 on aggregate. I think their coach, Claude Leroy, will be very happy with the fact that they scored 6 goals in the 2 matches, but will undoubtedly be a little bit concerned with the fact that they conceded 4.
The Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, draws 2-2 with Burundi, but they pull out the series 5-4 on aggregate. Your thoughts on the DRC, David?
Yes, Sonny, they fall into the same position as Cameroon, not doing as well at home as they did away. DR Congo winning 3-2 in Bujumbura, but at home, a last-minute penalty from Abdul Razak gave the Burundians a 2-2 draw. And it sort of confirms for me that the DR Congo, a very erratic, unpredictable side. I mean, they did exceptionally well at the last Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea earlier this year, finishing 3rd behind Ivory Coast and Ghana. That was a really good achievement by the side. But you just never know with the Congolese Lion, and these latest results, winning away and only drawing at home, sort of validate my point of view. DR Congo, at their very best, Sonny, they are probably capable of being one of the 5 African qualifiers for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. But equally, they could finish bottom of their group. They're talented, but they're extremely unpredictable.
Egypt, I remember you telling our VOA listeners, David, it's been a real long time since the Egyptians qualified for a World Cup. They lose the first leg in Chad 1-0, but come back to win at home 4-0 and win the series 4-1 on aggregate. Your thoughts on the Egyptians, David?
Yes, I mean, good point about the long absence of the Egyptians. It's, in fact, 25 years. Way back in 1990 when they competed in Italy. And their only other appearance, Sonny, was when you were probably a youngster. It was in 1934. You were just starting your radio show, Sonny.
Yeah, I think I was, David. You're right.
Sonny, as you said, trailing 1-0 from the first leg, but the Egyptians got down to business very quickly indeed in Alexandria. And what was nice is there was a 25,000 crowd, many matches in Egypt. There are no fans allowed at all. Now, this stadium holds 86,000. It's the Borg El Arab Stadium outside Alexandria. But nevertheless, some encouragement for the Pharaohs with that 25,000 crowd. And they saw El Naini and El Said score within the first 10 minutes. And then two goals from Hassan within 5 minutes before halftime had the Pharaohs 4-1 on aggregate. In the second half, Sonny, they clearly took their foot off the accelerator, cruised along, and I'm expecting quite a good challenge by the Egyptians this time. I think it really rankles with them that they've won the Africa Cup of Nations on 7 occasions. That's a record, but only twice have they qualified for the World Cup. So you could say the Pharaohs are long, long overdue an appearance at the finals, and I think they've very much got their sights on getting to Moscow in 2018.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. And David will pick up his World Cup qualifying analysis on Thursday's Sunny Side of Sports with Gabon. The Sunny Side of Sports remembers Jonah Lomu, the powerful New Zealand rugby legend who died early Wednesday of kidney disease at the age of 40. Rugby fans all over the world are mourning the passing of the man described as the sport's first global superstar. Among those paying tribute is New Zealand's Prime Minister, John Key.
This is a guy that's packed an enormous amount in the 40 years, but we've lost far too early. They knew that he had this condition, but he told the doctor not to tell the coaching staff. He didn't want to be cut any slack because he was suffering from this very rare condition that he had. He just had a real affection for the New Zealand people. He, you know, his proudest and happiest moments actually were when he pulled on the All Black jersey.
New Zealand Prime Minister John Key remembering All Blacks rugby legend Jonah Lomu, who died Wednesday at age 40 of kidney disease. Lomu had been receiving dialysis treatments during his recent visit to Britain, where he was heavily involved in promotional work for the 2015 Rugby World Cup. Lomu saw his beloved All Blacks win an unprecedented third world title in Britain. Rest in peace, Jonah Lomu. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up on outgoing United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe says not enough has been done by Harare to warrant America to lift the so-called targeted sanctions. And next, the Washington Mandela Fellow of the Youth African Leadership Initiative talks about the community-based anti-poaching work he has been doing in Rwanda. But first, some music. Here is George Okudi of Uganda with Africa Survival.
Nelson Mandela. Watch out the money, little children suffering by cooking for survival. Africa tonight, everybody's fighting for survival in the street.
Africa yang kwa minkuma imebadilika.
Africa is crying, the people and the children.
Giorgio Kudi of Uganda with Africa Survival.
Well, outgoing United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Wharton, says relations between Harare and Washington have thawed, but not enough has been done by Harare to warrant the lifting of so-called targeted sanctions. They were imposed by the U.S. in 2003 against President Mugabe and members of his inner circle for rights abuses and poll rigging, among other ills. Erwin Chifera reports.
Speaking at a breakfast meeting with journalists, Wharton said while the situation in Zimbabwe has improved, not enough has been done to warrant the removal of the so-called targeted sanctions on President Robert Mugabe and members of his inner circle. He said Harare continues to ignore court decisions, violate people's rights, and has not compensated white commercial farmers whose land was expropriated more than a decade ago by the government.
The implementation of the indigenization law has remained hard to predict, and it seems to change from time to time. And that has a chilling effect on an investor's willingness to put money into a country.
Wharton said the targeted sanctions, which affect 106 individuals and more than 60 companies in Zimbabwe, were not really an issue, adding a lot depends on the country's policies.
Sanctions are not the central issue here. The central issue are the policies enacted by the government of Zimbabwe, whether it's land reform or the way the law is enforced or tolerance for political violence. Those are the things that have driven this economy up or down. And sanctions are sort of a sideshow.
The outgoing ambassador said the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, ZIDERA, under which the sanctions were imposed, clearly spells out what Zimbabwe must do to have them lifted. But he said the U.S. president could use his discretion to scrap the measures if the situation improves. ZIDERA said Wharton also provides for American support of Zimbabwe's debt relief efforts, adding his country has done so by supporting the International Monetary Fund Staff Monitored Program and Zimbabwe's debt relief plans with the International Monetary Fund.
First of all, that we have supported the IMF staff monitor program here. Publicly and privately, we've supported that. And secondly, at the big meeting in Lima last month, we didn't bang our shoe against the podium and say no, no, 1,000 times no. We were supportive of that as well.
Wharton said Zimbabwe could boost agricultural production and revive its economy by giving title to landholders. He said clarity on the country's indigenization laws is critical, as this would help attract investment to the country. Also key in lowering foreign investors is political stability, Wharton said. He said the U.S. did not support political parties in Zimbabwe, but supports processes and principles of democratic elections. Wharton, who leaves Zimbabwe after a 3-year tour of duty, said he had done a lot to improve relations between Harare and Washington, adding the number of people on targeted sanctions had gone down by 25 during his tour of duty.
I've also been able to achieve high-level meetings between both government of Zimbabwe and U.S. government officials, and between private Zimbabweans, that is, business people particularly, and high-level Americans. So I feel like there's progress there. I think Washington has a deeper, more nuanced understanding of this nation.
He said Zimbabwe is a bright future, adding its economy could grow by 10% annually in the near future with the right policies in place. He described President Robert Mugabe as a lion of Africa, a leader who had liberated his people and fought apartheid through the frontline states, now the Southern African Development Community.
Robert Mugabe is a lion of Africa. You know, he has dedicated his life to creating a free and independent Zimbabwe. He's one of the leaders not only of Zimbabwe's liberation movement, but of the frontline states that helped bring down apartheid in South Africa.
From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Angi Imani Shimwe is a conservationist with the Rwanda National Park Service. He came to the United States as a Washington Mandela Fellow of the Youth African Leadership Initiative. He talks about the community-based anti-poaching work he has done in Rwanda. VOA's Philip Alexio has more.
Angi Imani Shimwe is passionate about nature. He's not just a tour guide at a national park back home in Rwanda, but he came up with a plan to save the environment from poachers who were destroying his beloved ecosystem.
I developed the approach of what I can call win-win situation. I said, let me put in place a community-based organization which can engage the community in biodiversity conservation, but also which can provide the economic development to the community around the Nyungwe National Park.
Ange was named Rwanda's top young innovator in 2012.
Okay.
With the grant money he won, he created a cooperative,
yes,
and he educated the poachers and introduced them to a new method of feeding their families and making use of their land. Ange purchased cows and got the poachers involved in the milk collection cooperative and the raising of livestock. He ended up creating 800 jobs.
Now, we gave jobs to the people who were poachers before. And now what we're doing is to see how we can create more green jobs and make sure that people can be really very healthy.
Ange's love of the environment and his passion to save it is what inspired him to become a young African leader. After studying civic leadership at the University of California at Berkeley, he was able to intern at Boston's Nature Conservancy. Apart from the lecture circuit, Ange's internship has been a hands-on experience with Mother Nature.
We are now on our way to Block Island to see the migratory birds and other animal species.
Block Island is a national wildlife refuge located 19 kilometers off the coast of the state of Rhode Island. Block Island is well known for more than 40 species of wildlife classified as rare and endangered. Moreover, it's a well-known stopover for thousands of migratory birds. Ornithologist Scott Cummings, he explains the frequent flyer pattern of the black and white warblers.
He'll fly 800 miles across the Gulf of Mexico in one flight.
800 miles?
800 miles. He'll leave like 6 o'clock at night, yeah, and he'll arrive at between, yeah, 11 and 1 the next day,
yeah,
in the morning.
Cummings and his group are licensed by the government to attach stainless steel bands to the migratory birds, known as bird banding, a means of studying the bird's migratory patterns.
And there you go. That's the best part.
A local beekeeper shared his tips on honey production Ange can bring back to Africa.
He's making 40 kilos per hive per year, and he has about 50 beehives, and he's making 2 tons a year. So it is really interesting, and I think it is what African people we can learn from him. We have potential markets in Western countries. I think I'm really very happy because what I learned in the U.S. met my expectations, and now I feel a very important person who can go and change the whole continent in terms of economic development.
Yali Fellow, Angie Imani Shimwe. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The American people stand in solidarity with the people of France in the wake of the recent and tragic terror attack in Paris. 129 people were killed in a string of coordinated assaults across the city Friday evening. U.S. President Barack Obama called the attacks an outrageous attempt to terrorize innocent civilians.
This is an attack not just on Paris. It's an attack not just on the people of France, but this is an attack on all of humanity and the universal values that we share.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry echoed the president's remarks, noting these are heinous, evil, vile acts. Those of us who can must do everything in our power to fight back against what can only be considered an assault on our common humanity. France is our oldest ally, said President Obama. The French people have stood shoulder to shoulder with the United States time and again. President Obama noted that the American people draw strength from the French people's commitment to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Now, we want to be very clear that we stand together with them in the fight against terrorism and extremism. We're going to do whatever it takes to work with the French people and with nations around the world to bring these terrorists to justice and to go after any terrorist networks that go after our people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, exceptional future leaders will gather for this year's World Bank's Youth Summit to tell the story of young people's role in the fight against climate change. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests discussing how youth can inspire communities everywhere to take action. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing.
So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.